Welcome to Vitality Made Simple. The following production is for educational and entertainment purposes only. If you need medical advice, call your doctor. Now, let's go to Vitality Made Simple.
Well, welcome to Vitality Made Simple. This is the podcast that's going to help you feel better, look better, and enjoy better relationships. I've got a special treat for you today. This is Dr. Ellen Langer. She is a Harvard professor. In fact, she is the first female to be tenured in the psychology department at Harvard. She loves her job. She's been such an inspiration to me because she's not going to ever retire, I don't think. And I totally relate to that. You know, and as we talk about on Vitality Made Simple, life's about relationships. So we're going to talk a lot about that today. Dr. Langer is the author of The Mindful Body. And The Mindful Body is a very fun and inspiring read that explains how we can actually scientifically proven, think our way into chronic health. She's taking it from that positive aspect. Welcome, 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 Dr. Langer.
Thank you, Debbie.
Now you've worked so hard. You're known globally as the mother of mindfulness. You're quite a luminary and a legend in this area. So you know, you've got all this research, all these great stories, and as I said, it's obvious that you love your work, which I truly admire. So defined mindfulness.
Yeah, I'm so glad that that's your first question, because often on these podcasts, I just go on for an hour and realize people never really know what I'm talking about. When people hear the word mindfulness, they tend to think of meditation. Now, meditation is fine, but it's a practice you engage in, the result in post-meditative mindfulness. Mindfulness, as we study it, has nothing to do with meditation, and it's not a practice. It's the very simple process of noticing new things about the things you think you know. And when you do that, you see, gee, I didn't know it as well as I thought I did. So your attention naturally goes to it. So when you're actively noticing, the neurons are firing, and 45 years of research has shown that it's literally and figuratively enlivening. Now, why don't people notice? And that's because they think they know. And let me inform everybody that none of us know. We can't know because everything is changing. Everything looks different from different perspectives. But schools, parents, media of all sorts teach us absolute facts. So we think we know. And when you think you know, you don't pay any attention, right? So if you were to adopt one mindset, and the only one I think you should adopt, is a mindset for uncertainty. And just recognize that you don't know, and then everything, and then you sit up, pay attention, right? And the work over all these many years has shown, when you do this, when you're mindful, you're healthier, you're happier, your relationships are better. It even leaves its imprint in the work that we do. So the things you produce somehow are also better. The fun part about it, not to overuse the word fun, is that this act of noticing is what we do when we're having fun. You can't have fun if you're not there. Sadly, all of research has shown that most of us are not there most of the time. When you're mindless, we can say you're frequently in error, but rarely in doubt. Now, the thing is, Debbie, that when you're not there.
Say that again, Dr. Langer. I want people to hear that.
Okay. Being mindless, we're frequently in error, but rarely in doubt. And I'll give some examples in a moment. And now I lost track of where I was going, but let's assume it wasn't worth going there. All right. So, I know what I was telling you, is that being mindful is what you're doing when you're having fun. And if you're not there, then you're not there to have fun, to have anything, okay? And most of us are not there most of the time. And you don't know when you're not there because you're not there to know it, all right? Virtually all of us are not there almost all the time. And my suggestion is, and the data are clear, that showing up is the best thing we can do for ourselves, for our health, for our relationships. Now, you mentioned that you're interested in relationships, that your listeners are interested in relationships. So why don't we start there? That, and all of this is in my new book, The Mindful Body. You know, let me just say, the mindful body is based on mind-body unity. You put the mind and body back together. It's one thing. Wherever you put the mind, you're necessarily putting the body. All right. So when you do what I'm going to suggest in a moment, you're not only going to improve your relationships, you're going to improve health. When you're mindless, you see people in a single-minded way, right? Being mindless, you give a single answer to questions. You're oblivious to the fact that anything can be understood in multiple ways. So let's say, Debbie, that you can't stand me because I am so gullible. Okay. And I can't stand you because you're so inconsistent. Well, no one wakes up in the morning and says, ah, today I'm going to be inconsistent and gullible. So what are they intending from their perspective? So for me, when I'm being, the reason I'm gullible is because I value being trusting. The reason you're inconsistent is because you value being flexible. It turns out that every single negative judgment we have has an equally strong but oppositely balanced alternative. For every negative, there's a positive. You see me as impulsive. That's because from my perspective, I'm spontaneous and so on. So let's say you and I are in a relationship, and now we have a relationship. It's just begun. Hopefully I'll continue. That if you try to change me and get me to stop being so gullible, and you convince me I shouldn't be gullible, but I'm always going to be gullible because my intention is to be trusting. So if you want to change somebody, what you need to do is understand from their perspective why they're doing what they're doing. Now, if you said to me, Ellen, I want you to be less trusting, both of us, we'd look at each other and say, what are you kidding? You know, trusting is good. And so when we do this, when we understand behavior makes sense from the person's perspective, or else they wouldn't do it, we tend to no longer be judgmental. And you can easily see how that's good for our relationships. People think that what they should do is just tolerate it. All right, so, you know, Debbie, I think you're great, you know, and so I'll tolerate the fact that you're so inconsistent. That's good enough. It's better than not tolerating it, but better still is understanding why you're doing what you're doing. And this, you know, this little simple little thing that behavior makes sense or the person wouldn't do it, of all the many findings, and hopefully we'll get to some of them today, is probably the most important to me because I see if you don't have a happy relationship, you can't be happy. If you're not happy, you know, you're going to be stressed, all sorts of things that turn out to be bad for your physical health. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't feel good. You know, that what happens is two people might have gotten together in the first place because they understood the other person's behavior from their perspective. So, gee, you know, I love Debbie because she's so flexible. And then somehow things change. And if we go back to what we believed about the person when we first met them and fell in love, I think that would go a long way in curing much of the relationship problem that people have. And then there are, I mean, there's so much to be said in this book that if we focus on relationships, there's a lot of data out there, most of it not mine in this case, on the importance of social support for our health. Much of the book is about health. And you're not going to be able to get social support if you've been demeaning your partner or the people around you, right? So by understanding why they're doing, the relationship gets better, you provide yourself with more social support, you're less stressed, and all sorts of other good things.
Oh, that's absolutely fascinating. I learned about you initially through your counterclockwise study.
Yeah.
And I, when you tell us about this, please go into detail, Dr. Langer, because sure. The setup was absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Well, so the counterclockwise, and I can call this famous study, because if you tune into The Simpsons Go to Havana, they actually describe the study.
No, it is famous and incredible.
But so I'm joking, but this.
It is.
Okay. This was the first test of the mind-body unity. Again, it, you know, people talk about mind and body, and then you have the problem. How do you get from a thought to something material like the body? And so that has held up progress for decades. I say these are just words, mind, body. It could have been mind, body, and elbows. Imagine how we'd understand people then. Let's put it back together, the mind and the body. Wherever you put the mind, you're necessarily putting the body. So we put the mind in unusual places and take measurements typically from the body. The first test of this was the counterclockwise study. What we did was retrofit a retreat to 25 years earlier. And then we had old men live there for a week as if they were their younger selves. So they spoke about the past as if it was just unfolding now. Right. So everything was designed to essentially step back in time. And so these people, you know, a write-up about these things doesn't fully get just how dramatic it actually was, because I'm sitting in my office. These people, these old men, are being brought to my office, typically by their adult daughter. And as they're walking to the to see and take tests and see if they can be in the study, and I'm saying to myself, oh my God, you know, I don't know if this person's going to live past today, no less live for a week where they're essentially going to be on their own. Okay, so that's the start. At the end, for me, the most exciting finding was that several of them no longer use their canes. I played football with them. It was touch football, but nevertheless, these are people who are really old and then magically not so. All right, so what happens is they're going to be watching movies from the past, having discussions about political issues of the past, all as if it's unfolding now. As a result, their vision improved, their hearing improved, their strength improved, their memory improved, and they looked noticeably younger. And all of this without any medical intervention. Now, obviously, I don't think, you know, I made people 25 years younger. I mean, it was, you know, it'd be kind of silly. But what the study suggests is that all of us are so much more capable than we believe, that all of the problems that we have may have solutions, that your vision starts to get bad. The assumption is, especially you're getting older, you know, most people say, well, what do you expect? As you get old, you fall apart. And the research here, that why it's so meaningful to me, that says, no, it doesn't have to be like that. And so then we went on to do many other studies. But you said before we went on air that you like. So let me tell two stories to bring some of this to life for people. How did I get interested in this? Well, the first, I was married when I was very young. I must say that the Mindful Body started off as a memoir. So there are lots of personal and sexy weird stories in it. Okay. So I'm very young. At this time, we go to Paris on our honeymoon, and I'm 19 going on 30. It's very important. I'm walking like I am all grown up. We go into a restaurant and I order a mixed grill. On this mixed grill is pancreas. I ask my then husband, which of these is the pancreas? He points to something. I eat everything else with gusto. I'm a big eater. I do everything, you know, full out. Now comes the moment of truth. Could I get myself to eat the pancreas? I had to, because after all, I was a married woman now. I start eating it and I literally get sick to my stomach. He starts laughing. I say, why are you laughing? He said, because that's chicken. You ate the pancreas quite a while ago. All right. So here I made myself sick eating something that I like and eat all the time. Okay. So that didn't, you know, that stayed with me, but didn't. It's consistent with the mind-body unity, but didn't give rise to it. What really did was the next study about my mother. Mm-hmm. And this is interesting, I think, because most people don't even have one pancreas story. I have two. All right. So my mother.
That's right. You sure do, Dr. Langer. I wish I'd thought of that.
My mother has breast cancer. The cancer metastasizes to her pancreas. That's the end game. Okay. Then magically, it disappeared. And the medical world couldn't explain it. And that became the reason part for all of my work over the next 40 some years. Mind-body unity does explain it, and go on.
What was it in your mother? What traits did she have that you attribute that to?
I think once, this was kind of bizarre, but again, I was young. When she was in the hospital, I took over her life. Now, the reason that was bizarre was because at that same time, I was studying the importance of perceived control on oneself. Okay. And yet I took over her life rather than, okay. And I didn't let anybody in who, in her room who wasn't upbeat and so on. And, so I believe that, she believed that this was all going to pass and perhaps had passed. You can't prove anything with a single example, but, because of that, it set me on a path to do lots of these mind-body unity studies. So let me give you an example of a couple of others. The next one was done with chambermaids. Now, we interviewed chambermaids, and the oddest thing, even though these women are exercising all day long, they don't think that they're exercising because they think exercise, according to the Surgeon General, is what you do at the end of work, and they're just too tired. So very simple study. All we do is divide them into two groups, and we persuade one of the groups that their work is exercise. We tell them making a bed is like working on this machine at the gym and so on. Okay, so all we've done is change their mind about what they're doing, right, for the two groups. We take many, many measures. They're not eating any differently at the end of this. They're not working any harder. But still, the group that now sees their work as exercise lost weight. There was a change in waist-to-hip ratio, body mass index, and their blood pressure came down, all because of their change of mind. And we have so many of these that people can read in the Mindful Body. Let me just give you... I'll give you one other.
I want you to be sure and tell about the diabetic study.
Okay, so that's fun. I'll do.
Yeah,
okay.
That's a fun one.
We have people come in to a lab who have type 2 diabetes. Again, we take lots of measures. Then we put them in front of a computer, and all of this will become clear in a moment, and they're going to play computer games. And we say to them, we want you to change the game you're playing every 15 minutes or so. Now, the reason for that is that we have a clock next to the computer. So this will ensure that they look at the clock. Unbeknownst to them, for a third of the people, the clock is going twice as fast as real time. For a third of the people, the clock is also rigged, but it's going half as fast as real time. And for a third of the people, it's real time. And what we find is that blood sugar level follows clock time, that is perceived time, not real time. In one of the most recent of these studies, we inflict a minor wound, but it's a wound still. And again, we're using a clock. I became clock crazy. I don't know why.
You have a fetish for clocks, I can tell when I read the book.
And again, so you have the wound, you're watching a clock, you're in front of the clock. The clock is going half as fast as real time, twice as fast or real time. And that wound heals based on clock time, perceived time. People in the sleep lab, they wake up, the clock tells them they have gotten 2 hours more sleep than they actually got, 2 hours fewer, or the amount of sleep they got. Again, biological and cognitive functions seem to follow perceived time. Now, people think of fatigue. We have lots of studies on fatigue as well, as something, the body can only do what the body can do. And they don't see it as a psychological concept. And again, the argument is the mind and body are a single unit. You put the mind someplace, the body will be there as well. So, let me give you an example of the simplest one. Let's say we tell one group to do 100 jumping jacks and tell me when you're tired. So they'll be tired at around 70. Now we take another group of people and we have them do 200 jumping jacks. Tell me when you're tired. They get tired at 140. Right. You know, yeah. You have to. Yes. Yeah. So people, again, have no conception of how much we can do. I ask my students, this is a Harvard class in health, and I say, OK, how far is it humanly possible to run? Now it becomes like an auction. You know, they know these are smart kids. So they know a marathon is 26 miles. They start, they know camp 26. So why would I ask the question? So 30, 35, 40, and it goes up, never beyond 50. And most of the classes, oh, can't possibly be. Then I show them a video of the Tarahumara, the tribe in Copper Canyon in Mexico, and they can run over 200 miles without stopping. That's a massive difference. And that's what I'm suggesting with everything we think we can do. There's a massive difference between how much we actually can do and what we think we can do. And there's a lot in this book that I think people will enjoy about language, because when you want someone to do something, oftentimes you tell them to try. Now, it's interesting. Try sounds positive. I don't think so, because you wouldn't try to eat an ice cream cone. You would just eat it. So try has built into it a possibility for failure. So we do studies when we have one group do it, another group try. And the doing always outperforms the try. I'm on language. Let me tell you a funny one, which is if I asked 10, well, we won't start that way. I was asked to give a sermon in one of the Harvard churches years ago. Now, I'm not religious. And if I were to be religious, I'm Jewish. So this whole thing was bizarre, but I tend to say yes to everything. So I say yes.
Thank goodness.
What am I going to talk about? And I really have no idea. That, well, how about forgiveness? It's not religion, but it sounds religious-y, you know, and I could get away with it. So I start thinking about it, and I come up with something that is actually, to some people, sacrilegious. Okay, here we go. Boil it down to a nutshell. If you ask 10 people, is forgiveness good or bad, what are they going to tell you?
They're all going to say good.
It's good, right. If you ask 10 people, is blame good or bad? What are they going to tell you? Blame is bad. Okay, well, just think about it, because you can't forgive unless you first blame. So our forgivers are our blamers. Now, do you blame people for good things or bad things? You blame people for bad things, but things in and of themselves are neither good nor bad. It all depends on how we frame it, how we view it. So what do we have here? We have people who see the world negatively, who blame and then forgive. And my conclusion is it's hardly divine. Okay, so this takes us back to where we started, and that if you blame somebody, it's certainly better to forgive than not forgive. But there's even better way to be, which is to understand from their perspective again why they did what they did. And then you don't need to, you know, I don't have to forgive you for being inconsistent, because you're not being inconsistent. You're being flexible. Okay. So there's a lot on language. And I don't know. I'm very excited about the book because it sort of summarizes and extends everything I've been doing for the last 45 years. And so we'll see. Hopefully people read it and like it.
No, I hope you all will read it and give it as a gift, because if someone's going through something tough, and many people are, it's a very hope-filled book. And I think it applies to any area. I mean, you're talking about, you know, thinking your way into chronic health, but that's every single area. Like you said, with stress, yes. The yeah. Worst thing in the world for our health is stress, and can be measured so well. You gave a great example in the book of, say, a 20-year-old who hurts their wrist. I mean,
yeah.
But then a 70-year-old who hurts their wrist. Well, the 20-year-old is like, okay, I'm going to be well, you know.
And no, the 20-year-old says, my wrist isn't supposed to hurt. So you do something about it. For the 70-year-old, well, what do you expect? As you get older, you fall apart. So you don't do anything about it. And so what happens is it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes. And I see this all the time with my clinical patients. They'll come in and say, well, I'm falling apart, Dr. Debbie. And well, I guess I'm just going to blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, the first thing we have to do is change your mindset. And so I give them affirmations and, you know, here's what you say to yourself. You've got to start telling yourself the truth. Your body is designed to heal, and this is an important part of it.
Well, it's also the fact that even if you're unsure whether being mindful will result in faster healing, that it feels good while you're doing it, mm-hmm. you know, and the alternative, the system is actually turning itself off when you just say, there's nothing I can do. I'm going to be stressed or depressed. But you said something about Christmas gifts, and I would love that. It made me think of one other thing that I haven't talked about before here, which is New Year's resolutions. So I argue that, and it's not in this book, but that making New Year's resolutions is mindless. And that's why they typically fail, because people don't appreciate why they're doing what they're doing. So, you know, and so what happens is you don't like the consequence. So you say you're not going to do the behavior, but you weren't doing the behavior because of that consequence. People don't drink in order to hurt the liver, right? So if they make a New Year's resolution, because I want to help my liver, I'm not going to drink, they're likely to fail, because that's not why they're drinking in the first place. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Okay. Whoa.
Because it's complicated, but I think that
we want to understand this. Yeah.
Okay. We're going, if you know why you're doing what you're doing, then you're happy with what you've done. If you don't know why you're doing what you're doing, and you just look at, you know, some negative, a negative version of the consequences, then it's, oh my God, how could I have done that? Even if we go back to what you said, oh my God, how could I be so gullible? But my intention is not to be gullible. So if I made a New Year's resolution, from now on in, I'm not going to be gullible. I'm surely going to fail, because what I'm intending is to be trusting. I like being trusting. And so I will continue there. It's another understanding of this is about regret. Lots of people have regrets. And the reason they have regrets is because they weren't paying attention, again, to why they were doing what they were doing. So this is a silly example, but let's say there's a party. You're giving a party. There are going to be all these important people there, and gee, people I'd like to meet. Okay, good. But I don't know this yet, right? You invite me to the party, and you know, I'm in that mood where the world is too much with me. I really just want to be by myself and do pretty much nothing, maybe even, you know, watch some television or just, you know, unwind, okay, if I were wound up. If I'm aware that that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, that I really need this, okay, then when I find out the next day that your party was the best party ever in the entire universe, and that everybody there went on to have wonderful new friendships that were good for their career, you know, I wouldn't regret not going. If I stay home, if I don't go to your party, and I don't know, you know, I'm not paying any attention to the fact that I'm making a choice based on, you know, what I feel I need, then I'm going to suffer regret. Damn it, why didn't I go? Okay. So when we're mindful, we know why we're doing what we're doing. And by understanding ourselves, we don't make New Year's resolutions to make changes. We don't regret our actions.
So
did I make that clear? Yeah.
Yes. But go back to the story about someone who decides, I'm going to stop drinking, and they think it's for their liver. So what indeed should they be?
Okay. Well, so if you think you want to drink less, then you need to ask yourself, well, why am I drinking? And ask yourself, how else might I achieve whatever the drinking buys for me? You know, the culture is too quick to make people feel bad about things that they do. Nobody drinks with the intention of hurting themselves, I don't think, or few, if many. And if people instead, if I said to you in the abstract, you're anxious, you're unhappy, and you do X, And after you do X, you're no longer anxious or unhappy. Is doing X irrational? You'd probably say no, right? Well, okay, so you're anxious and you take a drink, and now you're not anxious anymore. It wasn't irrational, but that doesn't mean there isn't a better response for you. Mm-hmm. And when you don't see yourself as doing these things because you're a loser, you're, you know, have no self-respect or whatever, and you're stronger, it's easier to come up with these alternatives. So, you know, this goes a long way in our appreciating why we do what we do. Now, what happens is the world is full of experts, and part of what experts try to do is tell you that everything you're doing is wrong. And then we can tend to believe them because, after all, they're experts. So one of my favorite of these, and I have a lot of this in the book, is about decision making. Now, most of us don't do a cost-benefit analysis. All right, you know, a complete cost-benefit. And we're told by decision theorists, some, that we're not making good decisions. Well, so if we take a mindful look at decision-making, we come up with something, again, really strange. You can't do a cost-benefit analysis because every cost is also a benefit. You and I go out to lunch, Debbie, and the food is good. Wonderful. You and I go out to lunch and the food is awful. Wonderful. I'll eat less. I'll have more time listening to what you're saying. You know,
that's awesome.
Do you understand? So outcomes are not prepackaged. The more mindful we are, the more ways we can understand anything that's going to happen, anything that has happened. All right. So you can't do a cost-benefit analysis. That's number one. Number two is that if you're supposed to gather information, nobody tells you how much information, right? It could be any new piece of information changes the sense. You know, do you want this dress or this dress? Okay. And you go through all the, you know, the colors in it, and then you find out, so you decide on dress A, the blue dress. Okay. And you find out that they don't have it in your size. So now you can't get that right. Okay, the point is, information, while nice, doesn't really help us make decisions. I don't want this to become too complicated, but I'll throw one more piece in that may end up too complicated than you and I can unpack it for people. Prediction is an illusion. We think we can predict because we're so good at looking back after the fact. The prediction is important for decision-making. But before, let's say we're at your party and we see John and Mary fighting. If at that moment I said to you, do you think they're going to get a divorce? You say, how do you know? People fight, right? But let's say I don't ask that of you. And then 2 weeks later, we find out John and Mary are getting a divorce. Ah, I knew it. You should have seen them going at each other at the party. All right. Afterwards, it's very easy, right? Going forward, I mean, you know, you just don't know. Okay. I did a thing in my class, graduate students way back when, where I would say to them, I have never missed a class. In 40 years of teaching this, I've never missed a class. What is the likelihood? I want you to predict whether I'm going to be here next week. So we go around the room. It's a small seminar, so 12 people. These are Harvard students. They say bizarre things. The first one says 97%. Obviously, there's no calculation. What they're saying is 100%, but they don't think they're supposed to say 100%. Right. So we go around the room and everybody virtually says 100%. I say, okay, now I want us to go around the room and everybody give me a good reason why I won't be here next week. The first one always says, you've always been here. You deserve the time off. The next person says, your dog has to go to the vet. The next person says, you've had a flat tire. Everybody comes up. So now we have 12 reasons why I might not be there next week. Now I say, okay, what is the likelihood I'm going to be here next week? And that 100% to 50%. We just don't know. Now, when you're making a decision, you're deciding between, I don't know what, it doesn't matter. I'll say A and B. The only way you can make this decision is if you predict your experience of A now will be the same as it was before. You know, do you want an apple or an orange? All right. And let's say you like both of them, that because if you don't like both of them, there's no decision, right? I'll take the apple. Okay. So you're assuming that if you choose that apple, it'll taste like the last apple. It'll be as pleasant tasting as it was before. But you're a different person now. Even if you had your apple just yesterday, you ate different things. You've done different things. Your body is just different. There's no way to know how much you're going to like that apple now. Okay, that may be taking this too far afield, so I apologize to your audience. Let's make it simple. You can't do a cost-benefit analysis. It makes no sense. So what do you do? And this will shock people. But rather than waste your time and get all stressed about making the right decision, instead, make the decision right. It doesn't matter. So now I send my students out again. I say, okay, I want all week for you not to make a decision. Flip a coin, decide on a rule that you're always going to choose the first alternative, whatever you do, but no decisions. They come back to class the next week and they say it was a wonderful week. It was stress-free because they didn't have to make decisions, which are based on these predictions. All right. So what does it mean to make it right that no matter what happens, the experience of it depends on the way you're going to frame it and appreciate it. You go on.
I really like that, Dr. Langer. I think, you know, that is making the most of life. That's looking for the good. That's, you know, could be called gratitude. I think it's fantastic. It reminds me, and please tell me if you were finished with your thought.
Yeah, I'm finished.
You are loaded with thoughts. I just so appreciate that. It reminds me of a surgeon in town, a very good orthopedic surgeon who has a reputation for being very arrogant. And he's very highly sought after, but he is very arrogant. And people talk about that. They don't mention him without saying that. But what he does is so incredible in my mind, because when he sits down with somebody, he takes their hand and he says, you know, we're going to replace that knee and you are going to feel great.
Yeah.
You are going to heal fast. You're going to be able to go do what you want to do. I mean, he's doing the mindful body as you're speaking about, and he has a higher level of healing. I mean, and people think it's only because of his great surgical techniques, but there are other people in town who have great surgical techniques, but they sit down, just like you said, they say, well, you know, there's a 50% chance that, you know, blah, 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 you know, and so all this stuff is implanted in their mind, which impacts their immune system. It's incredible. It probably leads us to the placebo effect.
So the placebo, it's kind of interesting because everybody knows what a placebo is. It's a nothing pill. But people don't realize this may be our strongest medication. So let's look at it. You have some problem, some illness, whatever it is. You go to a physician. He writes a prescription. You fill the prescription. You take what you think is medication, but in fact, it's just a sugar pill. And then you heal. Now, the piece in all the placebo research that I've objected to, like it's wonderful research, is that people then should know, hey, you know, it was just a placebo. What does that mean? If the pill didn't cure you, you cured yourself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what this book is basically about, is how do we cure ourselves? Mm-hmm. Now, you can't give yourself a placebo. Or, you know, I don't know how you can. I mean, I used to have motion sickness when I was in Chicago giving a talk, and you know, I'm a talker, right? So I'm late for my plane. I don't have time to take a Dramamine. All right. I grab a donut. The donut worked just as well as the Dramamine. And so I've never needed anything for motion sickness again. Since we can give ourselves a placebo, What we can do, we've developed a treatment that I call attention to symptom variability. And this is all described in the book. Mm-hmm. And that sounds fancy. Oh my God, attention to symptom. It just means being mindful. Mindfulness is noticing change, mm-hmm. right? When you're given a diagnosis of some chronic disease, people tend to assume it's going to stay the same or get worse. It turns out nothing really only moves in one direction. Sometimes it's a tiny bit better, sometimes it's worse, and so on. So people hold the direction still, assuming it's going to be awful forever, right? Now, what we did is we just call people throughout the day, throughout the week, mm-hmm. for big diseases, and we ask them, how is it now, and is it better or worse than before, and why? Okay, so three things happen when you do that. The first, since you think it only stays the same or gets worse, you're going to see sometimes, hey, it's actually better. And that feels good. Second, by searching for why is it better now than before, that initiates a mindful search. And as we've already said, this mindfulness is good for your health. I mean, we've done so many studies where we give old people, you know, we get them to be more mindful and they live longer. So it's a big deal. And third, I think you're much more likely to find a solution if you're looking for one. Okay, so we do this mm-hmm. very big, there's multiple sclerosis, a stroke, Parkinson's, yeah. More. And, you know, just to make clear to people, so let's say stress. I think it's true for just about everything. So let's say, Debbie, you're stressed all the time in your mind. No one is stressed all the time. But when you're not stressed, you're not thinking about stress. Okay, you're just being. And then you're stressed again, and that intervening okay period is sort of lost. So I call you periodically, and how are you now? Is more or less stressed than before, and why? And that why question is the important one. And you pay attention to the things around you, what's different at this moment? And you realize, you know, you're fine unless you're talking to Ellen Langer. Okay, well, if you're able to see you're stressed when you're talking to me, the solution is easy. Don't talk to me. All right. Or talk to me differently. All right. So now what I said with placebos, you can't give yourself a placebo. And it sounds like with this attention to variability, you can't, but you can. Most people have smartphones. So you set your smartphone to ring in an hour. And when it rings, you say to yourself, well, how is whatever the pain? All right, whatever the symptom is, and is it better or worse than before and why? And then set the clock to ring 2.5 hours later. And you know, just keep doing this throughout the day, random times. And what we found with these, again, very big disorders is that people are able to heal.
It's wonderful. You know, that kind of takes me back to what you talked about sleep. I see a lot of people who are wearing these devices to measure their sleep. And yeah. from my perspective, I'd like to hear yours. They are more stressed out about their sleep because yeah. they're like, oh, I only got this many, you know.
Yeah. Sleep. Okay. So there's so many myths out there, you know, that the medical world, okay. Medical science, all science, can only give us probabilities. That means if we were to do the exact same study again, which we can never do exactly the same, we're likely to get these findings. These findings are then translated as absolutes. They're probabilities, they're maybes, they're not absolutes. Okay, so how many hours of sleep does a person need? We're told in some absolute way you need 8 hours a night. Well, this seems to me almost silly. If I ran a marathon today and you were home watching television on the couch all day, it seems bizarre to think we would both need 8 hours sleep. Our day was so different. Okay. So many people worry about sleep because, oh my God, and they don't even ask themselves, mm-hmm. well, how am I functioning?
How do I feel?
Exactly. Well, you know, right. Which is the most important thing. And I think that many, I have a, you know, one of these fancy watches and it's fun. I see how many steps it tells me, but they can also get you crazy mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they're not perfectly calibrated. Oh my God. my blood pressure is all the way, you know, it comes up with a false reading and then causes the very thing. And so I think rather, you know, we can use technology and we should use technology and it can be fun. But the first place to find an answer is just ask yourself, how are you feeling? Mm-hmm. I wanted to tell you something about fatigue, which is kind of fun.
This is great.
I mentioned before, because I say everything in our mind represents itself one way or the other in our bodies. So Frank Beach, this is a study in the 50s or something, did this study with little rats. So you take a boy rat and a girl rat, and they'll copulate. And then what happens is the boy rat is tired. He needs a refractory period before he can go at it again, right? However, what Beach did was immediately introduce another little girl rat, and he didn't need the refractory period. Okay, so what is that saying? And we have lots of data to support this, that much of fatigue is context dependent. So imagine, to make it homey, you're word processing all day long. So you're at the computer, oh God, you're exhausted. And then the day is over, you go home and you play the piano. Looks like it's the same thing, except it's not. Mm-hmm. Because it's a different context. So you're tired, change the context, and then you get renewed energy.
Yeah, no, that's so great, because you can I can have a hard day in clinic, which I love. I absolutely love being in clinic, but then kind of, whew, I'm tired. But then we're going somewhere for dinner. It's like, oh, right, exactly. I'm all energetic. So,
right, exactly.
You know, it's really like changing context.
Exactly. We've all had that experience, but when people are having that experience, they often don't reflect on it and say, gee, I was so tired. How come now I'm not? And if you do that, reflect on it, then you see the next time you're tired, you have the means to mm-hmm. become untired mm-hmm. or energized.
No, it's so true. Tell us about risk taking. I think in terms of people who have gotten who want to feel better, who just want to feel with the most vitality, there is necessarily some risk taking in terms of health strategies.
Yes and no. That's the way people believe, exactly as you're saying, and I disagree with you and all those people. Okay. I again, remember I said that the Mindful Body was initially a memoir, so I have these stories in it. And this one I've never forgotten. I was a little kid, and I'm at the dentist's office. And when he's finished, and my mother is there, and he tells her she was such a good patient. And the first thing I'm saying to myself is, what are the other kids doing? All right. So it wasn't that I said, I could do this, I could do that. Oh, okay, I'll be good and I'll do this other. It never even occurred to me. All right. Most of us, when whatever we're doing, we do it because it makes sense to us, or else we wouldn't do it. Now, let's say you're driving with me. I wouldn't do this, but let's say I take a turn at 80 miles an hour.
I don't want to ride with you.
Right. Yeah. But I'm not doing it. Just for illustration. Okay. And you say, oh my God, you know, is she a risk taker? Well, what you're really saying is my comfort with my response mm-hmm. Exceeds your comfort or belief in mm-hmm. how good you are. Nobody takes the turn at 80 miles an hour saying, what the hell? Maybe I'll make it. Maybe I won't. You don't buy a stock saying, maybe it'll go up, maybe it won't. At the moment you do whatever you're doing, it's because you believe it will be successful. There's no risk. Okay, so now people who misunderstand that and think some people are just psychologically stronger, you know, might say, okay, I can do it, I can do it. And you go to a coach who tells you, you can do it, you can do it. And I think that that's the wrong strategy. So let's say I wanted to take this turn at 80 miles an hour. Mario Andretti, who's a famous race car driver, can take it at 80 miles an hour. What's the difference between the two of us? He's a better driver. He's not taking a risk. So if I want to be able to take, I have to learn how to drive better. All right, Greg Lugano. So if I want to dive into a small pond, I would never do it because I can't. I'm scared. Greg Louganis, tremendous swimmer, he wouldn't hesitate, but he's not taking a risk. He knows how to swim. So again, it's the same answer. You want to be able to do it. You learn more about it, and then there's no risk involved. And other people will see you as risk-taking. You know, just as that dentist saw me as well-behaved, I wasn't anything. You know, I didn't know at that point that I have options.
No, I think it's really important too with risk taking that people understand that, because I'm naturally a risk taker and get a lot of criticism for it.
I'm not a risk taker, and I get a lot of compliments for being what I'm not. Yeah. So there you go. We're both the same, that we do what we do because at that time it makes sense to do it. Other people wouldn't do it, so then they label us one way or the other.
But you can't listen to other people. You have to.
Right. Well, it's not just that. Remember that you need, I believe that if you saw what I saw, if you felt what I felt, you would do what I do. And that people, because they believe there's only one way of understanding things, that if I wouldn't do it, but you would, it must be because of the kind of person you are, rather than you're seeing the situation differently. I mean, I've taught this for so many years in classes and seminars. Let's say at a paddock, and there are five of us, and there are 15 horses that come racing towards us, and four of you run away, and I stay there. You decide I must be crazy, right? Because you believe the horses could kill you. Now, if I believed the horses were going to kill me, I too would run. Mm-hmm. But I love horses, and I think the horse correctly. It doesn't matter. In my mind, the horses are coming to say hello. So I don't run. Now, let's reverse it, that four of you stay there. I don't know how many we had of us. Four of you stay there and I run. Now I'm called a coward. And it's only because I believe the horses can kill me. And you don't believe that. All right. So people tend to think there's only one way of seeing the world. And if they just understood, the more mindful you are, the wider your world, the more options you have, you know, virtually at every turn. And as I said before, being mindful is energy begetting, not consuming. You feel good. It's what you're doing at play. It's good for you. Then people would be more mindful. We'd be less likely to point fingers at each other. To my mind, all aspects of our lives would improve.
No, I agree. And we want to find people that are more mindful, not mindless, because of this mindful contagion you talk about. Elaborate.
Yeah. Okay, this is wild. Yeah. I didn't know if you were going to ask me about that. I say this shyly. I had a chapter in the book at the one of the earlier drafts that was called the woo-woo chapter, right? And full of these things that happened that seemed to me really interesting, that, you know, and the publisher said, you know, they wanted me to get rid of most of it, not all of it. So I still have the mindful contagion. And I'm going to tell people what we found, but I want part of the It was so carefully written by me in the book, because I didn't want it, since it's so way out there, to negate all that had come before it in the book. You know, this mind-body unity, where I feel firm about the all of the advantages of being mindful. Okay, so we have a few studies on mindful contagion. I don't know which woo-woo one to tell you first. Okay, so we have people meditating in a room. Okay, so they're meditating. Then they leave. And now participants go into this empty room. They don't know that the meditators had been there. And we give them tests to take. Versus, there's nobody in the room. Nobody has been in the room. And now the participants go in there and take the same tests. When the meditators had been there recently, it's as if there's something in the air and performance improves. All right. We have, we're replicating that now in Cambridge. We have these monks who are going to be dressed like regular folk and in a movie theater. And there'll be several showings of the films. And the question is, when they're there, do people enjoy, which is what the hypothesis is, what they're watching more, because mindfulness is contagious. So and we have several of these studies. We know that people are aware when other people are mindful. When you're with somebody who's mindful, you see them as charismatic, trustworthy, attractive. And we have that even animals respond to people in this way. We have a study with, we'll go back to the alcohol you asked me before. I think that one of the reasons people drink too much, whatever too much means, drink a lot, let's say, is because they pick up interpersonal cues that most people don't pick up. They're hypersensitive, which should be a good thing. But because most people are mindless, when you're with somebody who's mindless, it throws you off. It makes you uncomfortable. So now we have a study. People show up for a wine tasting study. And the experimenter, so these are heavy drinkers. They come in one at a time and they're going to taste wines, right? The experimenter is going to be mindful or mindless. So when they're mindless, they're just counting, or, you know, they're not taking in new information. When they're mindful, they're very present. And this participant is told, you can drink as much as you want. You know, just tell us how good or bad the wine is on this or that dimension. When the experimenter is mindful, people drink significantly less than when the experimenter is mindless. And so people are aware. We have same studies with like people who are autistic. So what I like to do, Debbie, is to say this thing that everybody thinks is bad has an upside. Mm-hmm. And so people who are autistic are hypersensitive to other people's consciousness, mm-hmm. which is a good thing, not a bad thing. Right. But again, since most people are mindless, it ends up taking its toll. So we have people interacting with people who are autistic, who are mindful or mindless. And again, that when you're interacting with somebody who is mindful, your performance normalizes. Mm-hmm. You know, everything is better. You know, we have expressions, the light's on, but nobody's home. We get it this some way, but we don't have the word for it to say that person is mindless and it's making me not mm-hmm. feel so good. But we've all experienced it. You know, that an example that comes to mind that's not really an example of this, but let me say it anyway. You know, you ever talk to anybody who is passive aggressive? So I'm watching this interaction where one woman says to the other, oh, you got a haircut. Big pause. Then says, I like it. Well, you know that she doesn't like it because why did it take so long, right? But, you know, and then you turn around and say, well, you don't like it? And she says, no, I just told you I like it. And it's very hard to know what's going on there, right? And that's an example where you feel something and it's hard to touch it, to explain to people, but you know it's there. When somebody has been unkind to you when you have a language for it, then I think it's easier to call it out. Mm-hmm. You don't have to say to the other person, you're being mindless, but you say to yourself, there's nothing wrong with me. You know, we have some work in the book about bullying. It's the same sort of mm-hmm. Thing. I don't know if it's the same sort of thing or not, but when you're bullied by somebody, it's hard to know how to stop it, you know, whatever. You have parents who might tell kids, you know, it's not nice to bully people who are weaker than you are. And that, I think, is exactly the wrong instruction. Mm-hmm. Because what that says is you're strong if you bully, right? Mm-hmm. So we did some work where we tell people that if you know, that bullying is a sign of weakness. Nobody who has it together bullies. And if you see it as a sign of weakness, then why would you want to do it? Mm-hmm. And this is advice for little kids for, you know, I've told it many times to women in organizations being pushed around by men, where they need to know that if you feel bad, that person, nobody who's got it together again, who's mindful, who's the kind of person you want to be or be with, helps people feel this way, bad about themselves. And so the next time you feel pushed around, feel sorry for that person. Mm-hmm. And if you feel sorry for them, then that puts you back on top and it's much easier to deal with it.
No, I think that is a great strategy. I sort of look at it like they're coming out of their insecurity, which
is
a mindlessness state.
Yes.
And it changes everything. You're not offended if you know that they're.
That's right. You just feel sorry for them. Exactly.
You do.
Yeah. No. And all of this, it all becomes a single thing for yourself. If you know why you did what or why you're doing what you're doing, why you did what you're doing, you can stand tall. And then if somebody, you know, implicitly is slapping you, kicking you in the stomach, it doesn't feel, you know, like it might otherwise. And you say, gee, you know, I've done what I should be doing. It must be you. And it's much easier coping with a difficult world. Another thing that I go through in the book, we don't have time to talk about it, but is the perception of scarce resources.
So
people have, you know, an idea of winners or losers because they're fighting over a limited resource. And, you know, so they see the world as 0-1, you know, you win and I must lose. And for the things that we care about, there's an ample supply. All of us can be happy, healthy, and feel good about ourselves. And so all those people who are hell-bent on keeping some of us down, again, all we need to do is to recognize how mindless they are and how we don't need their approval. We can feel good about ourselves. The way to feel good about yourself is to recognize that everything is changing, so you can't know. It's not that there's something wrong with you for not knowing. Nobody knows. And to recognize that what you're doing is sensible or else you wouldn't do it.
Well, and this all translates to health because that's going to decrease stress. And when you decrease stress, your blood sugar goes down and your blood pressure goes down and your body
everything.
Is healing.
I'll tell you, Debbie, that I believe that stress is the major killer.
I agree.
I wanted to do this study before COVID and it hasn't happened and it's too complicated, but in the abstract, let's imagine we can get enough people who have just been diagnosed with cancer, all different kinds of cancer, the same number of people, and, you know, have breast cancer, have colon cancer, so on. And you know, nobody, if you just were told you have cancer, nobody's going to be happy, right? So let's give them a little time to settle into it. And let's say after 3 weeks, we now take each of these people and periodically we find out how stressed they are. We say every 3 weeks or so, once a month. I believe that stress response will predict healing or not, mm-hmm. over and above genetics, mm-hmm. over and above personality attributes, over and above genetics and treatment. I think stress is the major killer. Now, interestingly, stress is a psychological concept. Events don't cause stress. What causes stress is the view you take of an event. So if you take a mindless view, oh my God, this terrible thing is going to happen, of course you're going to be stressed. If you open it up and recognize, one, to be stressed, you have to think something's going to happen. You're making a prediction, which we said you can't predict, and you're predicting that it will be terrible. So it'll occur and it'll be terrible. So we should attack both of those. The first, give yourself 5 reasons it won't occur, because we don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So you go from thinking this thing is definitely going to happen implicitly to maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. So you feel a little better. Then imagine it does happen. How is that actually a good thing? And when you do this, after a while, you know, so for me, I'm enjoying talking to you enormously, but if my internet just goes blank, you know, it's not going to throw me off. You get to a certain age in life where I have had so many things happen. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, I think, another one-liner for people, when something happens, you say, is it a tragedy or an inconvenience? And it's almost always just an inconvenience. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, I missed the bus. Oh, my God, I didn't get the project done. Oh, my God, I forgot to call the doctor. You know, whatever it is. So just by taking a breath and saying that to yourself, you immediately calm down. Mm-hmm. And but if you think about what we've just said, both of us, that stress is terrible for our health. There's study after study making this clear. Stress is a function of our views. Our views are a function of our mindfulness or mindlessness. All we have to do is open ourselves up and recognize that everything can be understood in multiple ways. Some of those ways are going to be scary. Some are going to be delightful. You can, after realizing that, choose to think about the delightful ways, or just recognize whatever is, you know, that you don't have to. And that also goes back to what I was saying about mindful decision making, you know, that whatever you choose, you make it work, because everything has not just an underside, not just a silver lining, but an equal proportion is good, bad, or indifferent, depending on how you cognize it, the way you understand it. You know, I in the book, I talk about this major fire that I experienced, to say to people, look, you know, in my ivory tower, still I've had some pretty terrible things. I'm in probably the only person you know who was taken by two psychopaths, not just one. You know, okay, so with this fire, it destroyed 80% of what I owned. Now, you would think, isn't that negative? And it certainly, you know, felt that way at the time. I couldn't live in my house because it had just burned down. I move into this hotel. I have my two dogs with me, so I'm a sight. Everybody knows that I'm there because I'm the only one marching around with these two little critters. Okay, it was Christmas Eve. I go out for Christmas Eve. I come back to the room, and it's full of gifts, not from the owner of the hotel, not from management, but from the so-called little people, the chambermaids who made my bed, the parking attendants who parked my cars, the waiters and waitresses. It was beautiful, beautiful. And I tell you, I don't remember anything that I lost in that fire. But every Christmas, this comes back to me, and it renews my faith in people. So, you know, I'm not suggesting that people should want their houses to burn down. But even in situations that seem extreme, over time, at least for me, this turned out to be a blessing.
Because of what your mindset, because of what you chose.
Well, yeah,
that's wonderful.
No, and not just what I chose. No. In this case here, I mean, it was right in front of me. You know, these people leaving, you know, being so kind. And they couldn't have been that kind if my house didn't burn down. Mm. Right.
But you chose to see it as a blessing. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, that's just incredible. Well, I hope that everybody listening will read The Mindful Body or listen to it. It's full of great stories. You've heard just really a few. Dr. Langer is a fantastic storyteller, and she's fearless when it comes to thinking of experiments. I think your job must be really fun. You probably lay in bed thinking, ooh, we could try this. We could try this. There's a lot of aspects to her personality that are just incredible. She's also an artist. And so she uses this mindful approach to give herself permission to be creative, which is a whole nother topic. I think it's fantastic. So I just thank you so much for coming today. It's been a joy to meet you. I looked forward to this because I knew you had a spark in your eye when you talked about this, and you've been doing it a long time. It reminded me of, an airplane. You know, you're not landing, you're taking off. And that's just really incredible. So thank you, Dr. Langer, for your time. You're north, we're south, and it's just been a joy. And listeners, thank you for listening to Vitality Made Simple. We want to take the stress out of being healthy. We want to make things much more clear and help everybody have better relationships and feel better. We're now in 100 and I think 13 countries. Is that right? My boss is sitting over there. And we're in almost 3,300 cities. And that's because of you. And I'm now on Instagram, as you all know. And that's a new thing for me. It's a leap. But join me. I'm putting up an educational reel every day about how to help you feel better and enjoy your life more. There's a lot of humor. So you know, we have to, just like Dr. Langer said, we have to change our mindset, enjoy our life, look at things from a different perspective, and we're going to reap the health benefits. So thanks again for listening. Blessings until next time.